This podcast is a production of Bridges Church. Please visit us at www.bridgeschurch.net.
Well, so when Patrick asked me to preach this week, to be honest with you, last time he told me, he said, hey, we're going to be going through this big, long series about Canaan. This is the chapter and verse we'll be in. I said, well, that's easy. That's good to go. This time, I didn't really know what to talk about for a while. And it took some time. I had these different ideas, and then I listened to Troy last week, and he had talked about the idea of God being a father. And I was like, well, these two ideas kind of go with that, so let's, like, expand on that a little bit. There's all these names of the Old Testament that we, and the New Testament, to be honest, that we get of who God is, that help describe who he is, describe the nature of who God is. Some of the more popular ones would be El Shaddai, God Almighty, Yahweh, I Am, El Roy. I got to talk about that last time I was up here, if you remember. Hagar named God, the God who hears me. And then in the New Testament, one of the more popular names we get for God is Alpha and Omega, beginning and end. But the name Father, if I did a poll in this room, I suspect that there's a good chunk of you that would say God the Father is your favorite name for God. But at the same time, I think there would be several of you that say that the name God the Father is maybe the most difficult one to relate with. And that has everything to do with your relationship with your earthly father. Some of you just had difficult, maybe potentially abusive, absent, negative experiences with your physical father on earth. And because of that, it's just hard to relate when someone like me gets up here and talks at church about God being your father. There's a hollowness to that because it doesn't make sense to you as to why God and this earthly figure that you have of being a father could be the same thing, could love in the same way, could act in the same way, could treat you the same way. But on the other side of that, some of you had some amazing fathers growing up who were great men, who loved God, and who created this beautiful picture for you of what it looked like to be a fatherly figure, a healthy fatherly figure in your life. And then anyone on the spectrum could have someone in their life who was maybe a coach when you were little, a teacher growing up, a youth pastor, a boss, an employer, someone who was a fatherly figure for you, wasn't related to you. Maybe there wasn't much of a paternal relationship, but they just exemplified what it looked like in your life to be a father in some really healthy ways. And so if you fall into one of those last two camps, this might be a very endearing way to think of God, and it's very easy for you to connect with the idea of God being the father. But because it's difficult for some, and because in all reality, God the Father, it's just not reasonable or healthy for us to expect our earthly fathers or earthly father figures to be what God the Father can be. I want to just take a look at a few different stories in the Bible and a few different attributes of God the Father that kind of highlight the differences between God the Father and our earthly fathers. And that's not to discredit your earthly fathers or your earthly father figures. It's only to elevate the status of God the Father, right? Of what he can do that we are not able to do. And that's going to be a theme kind of throughout all these stories. So the first idea that I want to look at, the first attribute I want to look at, it's there on your outline if you have that in your notes, or if you just are writing down your own notes. It's this. God is a father who protects me. God is a father who protects me. And we could look at numerous stories in the Bible of how God protects his people. But the one I want to look at today is in Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14. You can go ahead and turn there if you have your Bibles with you. But while you're getting there, I'll go ahead and tell you the background story. And a lot of this is something that you'll know, but just to make sure we're on the same page, the Egyptians enslaved the Israelites for over 400 years, 430 years to be exact. A little bit of reference, we declared independence from England 249 years ago. So this is a long, long time. All right, this is not a short amount of time that these people were enslaved by the Egyptians. Now, Moses, who was born Hebrew but adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, was called by God to go tell Pharaoh as an adult to let his people go, his people being the Hebrew people, the Israelite nation, go and release them from slavery. And Pharaoh's obvious response to his first ask was no. Why would I do that? That doesn't make any sense. So God sends 10 plagues onto the Egyptian people. And after the 10th plague, which was the plague where the firstborn son in every Egyptian household died, but the Israelite household was spared because they put the ram's blood over the doorpost, Pharaoh said, okay, enough is enough. This is too much. Your people can go. So Moses leads the Israelites out of Egypt, and as they get a little bit further away, Pharaoh realizes, what have I done? Like, I mean, a lot of extra things would have to happen for Egyptians now. Like, all these slaves that they owned are now just free for nothing. Some people started questioning him. So he said, you know what? Let me send my entire army out to go capture these Israelites and bring them back into Egyptian slavery. So in chapter 14, verse 10, we're going to pick up the story where the Israelites are stuck between the Red Sea and the Egyptian army chasing after them, okay? So let's pick up there. We'll read through the end of the chapter. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent. The Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get the glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I've gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the angel of God who was going before the host of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was a cloud in the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, his horsemen. And in the morning watched the Lord in the pillar of the fire of the cloud, looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen of all the hosts of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. Now, there's a lot that we could obviously unpack from that passage, but there's one verse that I want to really key in on, and it's verse 14, and it says this. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent. Now, let's take one step back. Let's think about what God did in that passage. That's a story that if you grew up going to church, you probably learned when you were 3 or 4 years old in Sunday school. And it's potentially a story that now, reading it again, it's hard to really think through and fathom like what that actually meant and looked like, because it seems like it's just something you've always known, right? But think about it for a second. I was at the beach a few weeks ago near Wilmington, and it was the week between when those two hurricanes merged out in the Atlantic Ocean. There's some scientific name for it that Sean could tell you later. And it was really cool and weird, but it created all kinds of heavy surf, right? Like the water came up really high. The tide was really high. There was a riptide out in the currents that were really tough and difficult. And then the week after I was there at the beach, that nor'easter storm that kind of it's formed at least off the coast of the Carolinas and Virginia area. It was out there. It did kind of the same thing. None of those storms ever hit land in the Carolinas, okay, or near where I was. But the amount of power and the amount of energy and force that it created on the beach where I was, even though the storms were miles and miles and miles away, was incredible to see. And to think that water at that kind of a volume could be controlled and tamed in the way that God controlled and tamed the water to make a wall on the right hand and the left is an incredible thing to picture and imagine. And then to go a step further, they walk through on dry ground, ground that had been covered by water for centuries and centuries, thousands of years. Water covered that ground, and they walked through on dry ground. Now, again, I was at the beach the week after, so it did rain a lot, to be clear. I was in it, and it was raining a lot for those couple days, and the nor'easter was close to us. But the weekend after all that rain happened, I was at a soccer complex, and there were these porta-johns down by the field, and there's a lot of sands right at the beach, right? Well, the trucks that would come in to clean these porta-johns down by this parking lot in the back of the complex kept getting stuck in the sand because the sand was still wet, and they were spinning their tires, and they were burying them down to the frame. And one truck came to try to pull the other one out, and it got stuck in the sand. It was this whole big mess. But three times that weekend, trucks kept getting stuck in the sand because it's hard to move through wet sand. But the Egyptians walked through on dry ground with not any issue at all. It's a small thing, it seems like, when you read through the story, but that's an incredible thing, that not only were the waters walls on their sides, but they walked through on dry ground. And that the Egyptians had a completely different experience, obviously, right? They did not walk through on dry ground, and the water did not stay up as walls on the right and left-hand side, and that was the end of the Egyptian army at that moment in time as they knew it. What an incredible thing to think through. And, you know, I heard a general contractor one time say that it's hard to convince water to do the right thing. It's hard to convince water to do the right thing. And he was talking about just getting water to drain away from your house so that doesn't ruin your house and your foundation. But he said it's hard to convince water to do the right thing, yet God stood water up as walls on the other side of people in mass and volume. And we're talking about draining off water from a house when it rains 3 inches in a heavy thunderstorm in the summer. We're talking about, I can't even know, a sea, how many gallons of water that would be, but it is an incredible amount of water and force to have to hold up for hours upon hours while people walked through. Now back to verse 14 here. The Lord will fight for you and you only have to be silent. It would have been really easy to say, you know what, we have all these ideas of what we can do to escape the army. But the Egyptians, I mean, the Israelites were saying it's better for us to just stay in Egypt as slaves to begin with and just die there instead of dying out here in the wilderness. But even for the people who were trying to think of plans and game plan how we can get out of this, I don't think any of them thought of, let's part the sea and walk through on dry ground. That wasn't part of the equation, right? And that's kind of the whole point of the story, I think, is that it's so easy for us, it's so easy for them the moment to put these parameters and say, like, God, you can only work in the confines of our own understanding of how this thing can work. When God has this plan that no one could possibly think of, when God has this thing that is beyond imagined for us, doesn't make sense to us, but this is how he chooses to work. And so it's easy to say, that's what Moses is saying here, the Lord will fight for you. You don't have to fight for you, the Lord will fight for you. You have only to be silent. Now, to be clear, Moses didn't say you only have to be silent and then sit back and relax and just watch what happens next. There's still hard work to do. Walking through a sea doesn't seem like a small thing. It seems like a lot to do, especially when you're being chased by an army. That doesn't sound like fun. There's still work involved. There's still a part that you have to play in the process. But it wasn't your idea. It wasn't something that came out of your experience, that came out of your intelligence, that just some God said do this and you obey and you follow. Spoiler alert, this theme of putting God in a box is going to be a theme that we see throughout all of these stories that we read through today. Now, if you have your physical Bibles with you, you may not even have to turn the page to get to this next story. We're going to be in chapter 16, so you're welcome. While you're trying to find that, maybe flip one page, I don't know. I'll tell you what happened in chapters 15 and the beginning of 16. The first two-thirds or so of chapter 15 is a song celebrating what God had just done, this miraculous thing where God protected them and said, hey, you know, this is amazing, and can't believe God protected us in that way in this moment. And then a funny kind of humorous story maybe at the end of all of a sudden the Israelites start to doubt God and wonder, what are you doing? Because they don't have enough water. They're in the desert, and there's not enough clean drinking water for them. And so they say, God, what are we doing? why did you bring us to the desert? There's not water for us to drink. And I get it, like you do need water to survive. But God had just done this pretty amazing thing. Why would you think he would take you to a place and not provide for you there, right? Which is the next point, by the way. But in the end, God tells Moses, take a plank of wood, throw it in the water, and it became clean and pure for them to drink. And so God provided for them there. And then in the beginning of chapter 16, you see, again, the Israelites start to doubt God. They say, they go as far as to say that God, we would have rather been, again, we talked about this in the last chapter, we would rather be in Egypt right now, because at least in Egypt, we had all the food we could wish for. We had pots of meat. We ate as much as we desired. But here in the desert, we have nothing. So our next point that we're going to see in this next chapter here is God's a father who provides for me. God is a father who provides for me. He provided water in 15, but here in 16, we're going to see how he chose to provide food despite their grumblings in the beginning of chapter 16. So we'll pick up here in verse 4 of chapter 16. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them, whether they walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us? And Moses said, and the Lord gives you what the Lord gives you in the morning and the evening to eat meat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling, that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of your people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp. In the morning, dew laid around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost in the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is that? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer according to the number of persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over. And whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over until morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till morning, and bread worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as they could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till morning. So they laid it aside till morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, in the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread of which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And Omer is the 10th part of an ephah. So again, a lot in this passage we could dive into, but I just want to look at two really key things from the passage. The first, if I could add an end, the things on your outline, they kind of go together really well, but if you could add like a parenthetical at the end of this point too, God is a father who provides for me what I need when I need it. No more, no less. But when I need something, God provides for me. And the Egyptians, in two different ways, right? Both in the morning when they went and took as much as they could, and then they tried to save some for the next day as if God wasn't going to provide for them and do for them the next day what he did for them today. And then again on the Sabbath when they went out to try to find even more, even though God had already provided for their needs for that day. They didn't trust that God would continue to provide the way that he provided, which he continued to do for 40 years. Again, not a short amount of time. And I think we do the same kind of things. I'm a person who likes some security in my life. I enjoy the fact that there's a little bit of money in my bank account in case something happens and I need it to be there. I enjoy the fact that I don't have to live paycheck to paycheck because the idea of that is a little concerning to me. But I say all that knowing and believing still that God is a God who provides for me. And so sometimes those two things don't always make sense and gel completely together, right? And I'm not saying we should go and empty your bank accounts or go and quit your job because God will provide for you whenever you ask him to provide for you. But again, we talk about putting God in a box a little bit and saying, I can only understand how you can work if this happens. I can only understand how you can provide for me if I have money in the bank that I have saved myself. I can only understand how you can provide for me if this job that I've worked so hard to obtain continues to be the job that you allow me to have. And when those things are taken away from us, it's hard for us sometimes to understand how God can work in those moments and work in ways beyond our own limited understanding of him. The second quick point here I want to make from the story is to remember when God shows up. So here near the end, Moses instructed the Israelites to keep an omer throughout your generations so that they may see the bread of which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And then he tells Aaron to take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. Remember when God shows up in moments like this in your life. Write it down, and if you don't journal, find something physical to remember these things by, because we've seen the Israelites be saved from an army chasing after them and go through a Red Sea. And in the beginning of chapter 4, it tells us this is a mere month and a half after they left Egypt. So all this has happened in a very short amount of time, a matter of days and a few weeks. Then God provided water for them in the desert, and still they didn't trust that God would provide for them when they were hungry. And it's easy to look at that and say, well, that's just silly, and the Israelites just continue to mess up time and time again throughout the Old Testament. And that's true, but it's also forgetting the fact that we do the same exact things, and that it's so easy for us to praise God for providing for us in one area of life, and then a few weeks later, we're met with a similar difficult situation, and we don't remember, don't believe, don't have the same kind of faith that God will protect us in this way, the same way he protected us and provided for us in this way. It's such an easy trap to fall into. So remember these things, write them down, keep these things, these Ebenezer we talked about in the Old Testament, keep these things that help us remember when God showed up in some pretty big ways in our own lives, in ways that may only impact you and may mean nothing to other people, but they impacted you in some significant way to help you remember you for the next time. The last story, you're gonna have to turn your pages a little bit for this one. It's in Mark chapter 4. It's a little ways away. But the attribute of God, the last one we'll end with in this chapter is God is a father who comforts me. God is a father who comforts me. This is a story you'll probably also likely be familiar with. This is going to be Jesus and disciples in a boat in a storm. So we'll pick up here in verse 35 and we'll just read straight through it here. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. Again, this is Jesus and the disciples in a boat. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern asleep, Jesus, on a cushion. And they woke him and said, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Now, I'm shortchanging all of these stories just a little bit today. We could probably spend all morning talking about this story as well, but I just want to pull out two quick things from the story. The first one is when the disciples go in and the storm, and you have to give them a little bit of grace here, right? That there's a storm happening. They think they're about to die. They say it to Jesus, "We're perishing, we're about to die. There's the wind is coming, the waves are crashing onto the boat, the boat's filling up with water, this isn't good, and you're asleep? What is happening? Why do you not care about us, God?" And on the surface, you think that's not a reaction we've ever had, but, and don't have to raise your hand for this, but have you ever asked the question, like, "God, do you even care that I'm sick and I'm in pain and I'm hurting right now? Or God, do you even care that I just lost my job and some sense of identity that I had in my life? Or God, do you even care that I'm in debt and I don't have this light at the end of the tunnel to see to get out of this thing? Or God, do you even care if my marriage is falling apart and my relationship is falling apart? Or God, do you even care?" And fill in your own blank to that question. And that the answer is gonna be, we all have said something along those lines to God before, probably multiple times, even though it seems silly again. And just like with the Israelites earlier and how silly it is for them to think that God won't take care of them and provide for them and protect them, it's silly to think that God doesn't care about us. He does. He cares about all these things and he will take us out of them. But again, we get set in such a narrow mindset of this is how God can take care of us and this is how God can provide for us and this is how God can comfort us and he can end the storm. We'll talk about this here in a second. He just ended the storm in a moment's notice, right? He can do those things, so why doesn't he? And it's easy to think that this is God not caring about us when it's limited mindset, it's limited thinking in our own understanding and our own experience in our own life. And the second point I want to talk about a little bit here is the two different messages that Jesus has for the storm and then for the disciples. So first with the storm, he tells the storm, "Peace, be still," and it just stops. Which, a quick aside, what an amazing thing to experience. Maybe just as amazing as the Israelites walking through the Red Sea, to be in the middle of the storm that you think is about to kill you. And then this guy awakes from sleep and just says, "Peace, be still," and it stops. I mean, this is the most chaotic situation you've ever been in your life. If on a boat, I don't boat that much, but when I do, I feel like I have less control of my life and everything happening around me than basically any other time that I've been on any other transport, motor transportation, the boat in the middle of a lake, especially in Canada. But at the end of the day, God told them, or Jesus told the storm to be still, and they were still. What an amazing thing to have experienced and seen. But then the next message he has is for disciples. He says, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And again, there's this difference in saying, just like with the provision from the last point here, there's a difference in saying that I find my peace in Christ and actually like acting like I find my peace and comfort in Christ, right? There's just a small difference in those two things. And they weren't acting like they found their peace and their comfort in Christ in that moment in time. He said, "Have you still no faith?" And they lived with the guy. They got to experience all kinds of things that he did. They knew him better than anyone on earth knew him at that point in time. They still didn't have faith. And we fall into the same trap often ourselves. So as we wrap up this morning and we go into communion, I want to leave you with a story. My 5-year-old son, Jonah, I don't know why I'm getting emotional about this. It's not that emotional of a story. But my 5-year-old son, Jonah, he's a funny little kid. And sometimes he's really smart too. But he walked into the kitchen one morning to my wife, Jill, and he said, "Mommy," he seemed concerned, and Jill didn't know why. He said, "Mommy, I know who my grown-ups are. Like, you and Daddy are my grown-ups, but who are grown-ups' grown-ups?" And he paused for a second. And he said, oh, wait, I know. God is the grown-up to grown-ups. And Jill said, well, yeah, that's right, Jonah. God is the grown-ups to grown-ups. And when she told me that story, like, I smiled, and it made my heart a little warm that Jonah, one, he's getting it, right? That's a nice thing as a parent to think maybe some things that you're saying are actually clicking when the rest of the week doesn't seem like it is. Maybe he's understanding about who God is and Jesus is, so good job, Sarah, and everyone else in the preschool room, and Jill as well for investing in him in that way. But it also made me think, man, like, that's a really deep thought. And I don't know how deep into that he really got, into the idea of God being the grown-up to grown-ups. But I think as a kid, like when you fall off your bike and you scrape your knee, who was there to hug you and to take care of you and put a Band-Aid on and treat that injury that you had? It was, if not a parent, a paternal figure in your life. When you were playing sports and you fell down and you broke your arm in gym class or something, who was there to take you to the doctor's office to get them to put the cast on it, and then to help you put a trash bag over it so you could take a shower, and then to help you figure out how to get dressed again, all the things that you have to do when you break bones? Your parents were there to do those things for you. And who was there for you in second grade when you come home from school and you're upset because this kid at school said something mean to you? And who spoke truth into your life and told you who you really are? It was your parents. The person that takes care of you. It's all these little things in your life to take care of you and to help you grow and become the human being that you were created to be and called to be by God. And when you become an adult, sometimes those tough things can feel lonely sometimes. Sometimes you feel like you're a little bit alone in those moments. And while I hope and pray that your small groups and that this church as a whole is a supportive community and environment that comes alongside people in those moments of the greatest need that they have, there's still something a little different about that than the grown-up that you had growing up as a kid, who was there for you the entire time, who never left your side, who cried with you, held your hand through all those little things that were tough. And it's comforting to know that even as an adult, and even in a more impactful and caring way, that there is a grown-up, God the Father, who is there with us through all these things, that if we just let go and stop trying to fix all the things that come up in our lives and try to navigate through all of these things ourselves and come up with solutions that fit within our own understanding, that God is there to walk through that with us and to carry us through in ways that maybe we can't even imagine ourselves. We all need a grown-up in our lives for the times we know we need a grown-up, and maybe sometimes we need a grown-up in our lives and times we don't know we need a grown-up as well. So as we come to the table this morning and take communion and remember the sacrifice that Jesus made on the cross for us, that God made by sending his son to die on the cross for us, which, by the way, the most beautiful moment of a parent could have, like, sacrificing for us so that our sins could be forgiven and we could have a relationship with him. I want you to think through a little bit, what are some areas in your lives, and reflect on this, that maybe I'm holding on to too tightly. I'm not letting God be the father figure in my life that I need him to be. Or some areas of my life that I need help, that I need that father figure, that I need that paternal figure, that I need someone to comfort me, to provide for me, to protect me, because what I'm doing just isn't working. So I'm going to pray, and you can come up to the tables in the front, take communion at your own time, but I want you to spend some time reflecting on that this morning. What are some ways that God can be your father figure in ways that you aren't letting him be today?